Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Investors are always looking for an edge in the stock market. For years, financial investment firms have used computers and data analysis to make predictions and quick trades. And as developments in artificial intelligence continue, some are betting smart software might be the future of the stock market. Joining us now by phone is senior editor at MIT Technology Review, Will Knight. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me.
So Wall Street's already using computers to make those lightning-fast trades based on a variety of algorithms. How long has that been going on, and how does that work?
Right. Well, so that's been going on for years now, and mainly it's pretty basic in its in the kind of intelligence that's involved. So it's usually about sort of automating a trade to beat someone else to sort of hedge them out of the market. So most of the stuff that goes on is fairly simple. That said, there are companies that have been looking to do more advanced stuff and looking to, you know, use pretty sophisticated statistical techniques, mathematical models, and that for the last kind of decade and a half. And some of those have become the big sort of beasts in the hedge fund world. There's companies like Renaissance, who are very secretive, but we know they're founded by very well respected mathematician and scientists, and so they use techniques that, you know, you might almost say were artificial intelligence.
Right. So to what extent are humans involved?
Today still there's a huge amount of involvement of people. It would be unfair to sort of say that these things were entirely autonomous. But there's been a growth, a rebirth of interest in artificial intelligence, which you've seen a lot of tech companies embracing the latest sort of advances there. We're starting to see more companies try looking at these very advanced artificial intelligence techniques and some startups kind of trying to move into that. So I think there's definitely a general interest in trying to embrace some of these techniques as things move very quickly, you know, like the way that Facebook is able to recognize the people's faces. That sort of technology has only emerged in the last few years, and it's very impressive. So people are starting to think, well, maybe we can take some of these newer AI ideas and apply those to the market.
And how would it be applied to the market?
Well, so that's a great question. I think that's something that people are kind of wrestling with. So some of these techniques are really sort of not designed to handle huge amounts of mathematical data and look for little statistical edges. So people are starting to they're thinking about applying them in some interesting ways. So, for example, people are looking at using computers to parse newspaper reports, financial earnings reports, basically huge amounts of information that a person wouldn't have the time to do that very quickly, and using some of these techniques, try and extract some meaning from it. So if you can read a long newspaper report and actually understand what's meant by some of the stuff in that about, say, a particular company, that could give you a signal as to what you should be doing in terms of trading. And that's potentially one of the most interesting sort of areas, because it's really sort of taking something which is quite a human skill and trying to apply it there.
Is it something of an arms race?
I think that trading is always something of an arms race.
Right.
It was very fun to report this story because these companies are extremely secretive generally, and at the same time they're also trying to sort of build their reputation as being very cutting edge, and they're genuinely sort of looking to recruit a lot of computer science, mathematical, and AI talent. So yes, it absolutely is sort of an arms race, but I think that's always been the case. People are always looking for the latest edge, and I should say that there's been a long history of trading companies coming up with the latest new big idea and falling by the wayside pretty quickly. So it's a very kind of fiercely competitive, ruthless kind of market.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about artificial intelligence in the stock market. After yesterday, maybe it might help. I don't know. My guest is Will Knight. He's a senior editor at the MIT Technology Review. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post a question or a comment there. So you said there are firms out there, you mentioned Renaissance, that might be actively trading with this type of technology. They're very secretive about it at this point.
Oh, yeah. So there are definitely are companies. So there's a sort of broad range of companies using different techniques, but there are some companies, some newer ones especially, that say that they're using very automated systems. So, you know, traditionally, as we were saying, we were talking about the sort of algorithms you'd use, you would be kind of supervised by a person, and they would be going in and changing stuff every now and again and seeing how it performs. But some companies are saying that they're using systems that are very much more automated, and they're claiming to have pretty decent results. I think there's no one has sort of emerged as having like incredible returns with this, but yeah, there definitely are companies doing it, and it'll be interesting to see how they do.
Yeah, well, Bernie Madoff said he was doing well too, but he turned out to be sort of a flim flam man.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, trading stocks is always risky. Most people do it through mutual funds; they don't do it on their own. Is there any reason to believe that artificial intelligence trading would be any more or less so? I guess what are the pratfalls potentially?
Well, that's a great question. So we're starting to see, you know, some more sort of automated systems for actually advising people to do their own investing as well. That's a kind of trend within firms that offer financial advice. They're starting to offer these kind of robo advisors. I think that stuff is still very much kind of based on trying to extract human expertise and present that sort of more and automate that stuff. I don't think there's that much risk with that. And I don't know, you know, how well these companies are doing. I think the sort of bigger risk, as with this sort of technology, as with automated trading generally, is just this kind of systemic kind of fragility of the market, where everything is trading at very high speeds and everything is doing stuff automatically. You can start to have some unpredictable behavior, and we saw that a little while ago with a number of flash crashes, and also with some big firms that lost huge amounts of money because of their algorithms did something very, very unexpected, and it worked so quickly that it wiped huge amounts of money off their books. So I think that's probably the bigger risk is probably still, you know, human beings implementing the technology not so well and perhaps relying on it too much.
So talk about, you know, take it a step further when you talk about artificial intelligence scanning and processing news stories and posts on social media and sort of taking all this information and then having that play out in a stock trade. Can you tell us how that might work?
Well, yeah. So for example, one of the people behind Watson, which is this IBM computer which competed on Jeopardy, he's now works at a hedge fund, and so the way that Watson was designed to go through huge amounts of encyclopedia information, web information, and try and actually make sense of it. So this is a really, really difficult challenge, right? Because processing language is not easy. You know, there are always ambiguities and great complexity involved in that, and it requires kind of, for humans, it requires a knowledge of the real world. So this guy's gone off to work at a hedge fund, and they would be ingesting huge amounts of data and I believe sort of trying to then say, well, maybe, you know, the signals we're seeing across Twitter, across news reports, across vast numbers of media reports are giving us this sense that maybe this company is a bit more promising than we thought, and so you might want to invest in that. But really, so some of the stuff they're doing is actually fascinating, because it really does cut to some fundamental challenges in artificial intelligence.
So it would be suggestions to people to do something.
I think so. Yeah, I don't think at the moment, even though people like to sort of talk up how you know, how brilliant their AI systems are, I don't think that they're sort of letting them run off and do whatever they want for a week. I think really the people at the moment, at least, trying to use that to extract information, the same way that, you know, companies are trying to, so IBM is trying to do this with the commercial version of Watson. They're trying to extract a lot of information from written reports, say, or you know, scientific papers or medical papers, and then inform a doctor. So I think it's something similar to that.
Jim in Columbus, you're on the air with Will Knight of the MIT Technology Review. Hi, Jim, you're on the air.
Does your guest think that or believe that quantum computing is being used on Wall Street yet? And if not, when does he see the advent of that, which will eventually be the end goal of artificial intelligence? And what will the result of that be once quantum computing is put into effect?
Okay, Jim. First, Will Knight, can you tell us what quantum computing is?
Sure. Yeah. Hi, Jim. We actually have, it's funny you ask this, we have a couple of stories about quantum computing, about the latest advances in quantum computing on our website, if you want to go and check that out. So quantum computing means using quantum effects, which are non-conventional physical effects that happen at the quantum level, at the very, very, atomic level, where matter does not behave in the normal sort of way. And what that means to simplify it probably very bluntly is that you can start to do computations that in a vastly more efficient way. So you can do computations that would take a very, very long time to do normally extremely quickly. So now scientists have built a lot of experimental quantum computing devices using various different weird exotic phenomenon, but those are all extremely crude by and large at the moment. There are some efforts, and Google is involved in an effort along with a company called D-Wave to commercialize this, and they're building and along with some other companies, they're building some early quite simple quantum computers, but I think they're a long way from actually being applied everywhere. I don't know certainly of any financial companies that are applying quantum computing. What that would mean, the basic idea is that you can do computations much more quickly. So I do know some researchers are looking at how maybe quantum computing could be used for some technologies related to AI. I think it could certainly speed up those processes. I'm not really sure how quickly that's going to happen, because this is something which is extremely difficult to pull off and make into a real computer.
Is there any sense about how all of this might be regulated in the future? Is anybody thinking about that?
Well, I'm not sure they're thinking about specifically quantum computing this bigger AI, but
yeah.
Certainly in terms of automation, I think that there already have been some measures introduced to try and catch these kind of runaway effects that can happen when various traders are doing stuff automatically, and it has this unintended kind of feedback loop. So I'm sure regulators are looking at that, and I know that a lot of academics are certainly concerned about the complexity that's been introduced into the market. But as you know, regulation is a complicated matter, especially where there's a lot of money involved.
Right. But if I'm a big investor, say for, PERS and in Ohio, public mm-hmm. employee retirement system, do I have any kind of right to know how they're doing things like that?
That's a great question. I think at the moment you don't have a right to get into the specific technologies that companies are using, but I'd have to look into that a bit further to figure that out.
All right. Well, Will Knight, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
I appreciate it.
Will Knight, he's a senior editor at MIT Technology Review. Coming up, more Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Facebook leads the world in social media. As a comparison, more than 100 million people use Instagram every month. More than 1 billion people are active on Facebook. But since 2011, more than 11 million of those happen to be young people who have left the social media giant. Their habits are changing. Felicity Duncan is an assistant professor of digital communication and social media at Cabrini College in Pennsylvania. She recently wrote about this trend for the Christian Science Monitor. She joins us now by phone. Felicity Duncan, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Ann.
Let's start out with just definitions first. Facebook is an open social media. What is that, and what are the alternatives?
Essentially, Facebook is a platform where you create posts and you have the option of kind of broadcasting those. So you can you know, you can set your profile to be private, but a lot of the defaults are in Facebook, are for anything that you post, any photos you share, to be viewable by really anybody, which is why I describe it as an open or a kind of broadcast platform.
Okay, and the alternatives?
The alternative is platforms like Snapchat, which is you know, something that's becoming wildly popular among younger people. With Snapchat, it is the sort of native way to share messages is to send a specific image to a specific group of people that you select or put into a group. So you could send it to your 20 or 30 or 100 closest friends. But that image is not viewable outside of the network of people you choose to send it to. So it's a much more intimate sort of small group or narrow cast platform.
And pardon me, when you talk about native way, you're talking about digital natives.
Well, when I talk about native, I mean the settings of the platform. So, you know, for Snapchat, okay, the settings are all, you know, let's keep this in a small group, whereas for Facebook, the sort of default settings are let's broadcast this out.
Okay, and let's talk about who these 11 million young people are that have since 2011 dropped Facebook or aren't regular users of it. They may still have their own, but they just don't check it out very much. What do we know about them? Is there anything special? Are they digital natives who've grown up with computers?
Yeah, definitely. These are typically young people. In the case of the 11 million people who've left Facebook, what that data is referring to is the fact that Facebook's sort of penetration among teenagers is actually falling in comparison to other platforms which are growing. So 11 million of the teens who should be on Facebook are not there or have left. You know, they're digital natives, they're people who grew up in a social media environment, but are opting not to enter the Facebook universe, but instead are choosing a range of other platforms to meet their communication and social needs.
You're saying they're not even entering it at all.
Yeah, many of them are not, and some of those who do enter, you know, leave and end up with, you know, ghost profiles that are not updated and not checked in with.
Right. You talked with 80 college students to hear their thoughts on social media. What were some of the big takeaways from that?
It was very interesting. You know, I sit in my classes, you know, before the class starts, the students sit there and they're all on their phones. And we got into a conversation about, you know, what are you doing on your phone when you're waiting? And it's not social media. That's not what they're doing, or, you know, broadcast social media. What they're doing is they're checking messages, they're checking Snapchat, they're checking communication from their close friends in private forums and private platforms. So, you know, not Facebook, but maybe they use Facebook Messenger, where, you know, there's six or seven of them having a chat that is not visible to anybody else. So that sort of struck me as interesting. They're not looking at, you know, the latest tweets from celebrities anymore. They're really looking at the sort of goofy selfies that their friends are taking and sharing in their private network.
Well, why do we know why that is? Is something changing? Is it a generational thing or what?
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, I asked them about that, and I think there's a couple of reasons for it. One is that the students have become quite a lot more sophisticated about understanding that what they share on these broadcast platforms is there forever.
Ah.
And, you know, they've seen incidents in their schools or in the you know, news media where people's five-year-old tweets are used as evidence of their, you know, terrible personalities. I've seen people who don't get jobs because of things they posted when they were in college. So they're a lot more wary and a lot more aware of the sort of permanence of that type of communication. And then the other, I think, big driver is that these days, you know, they're friends with their mom on Facebook, they're friends with some of their professors, and so they don't want to be, you know, they don't want to be sharing necessarily what they were up to on Friday night when they know that, like, their gran is going to be seeing those photos. You know, they want to keep that kind of communication for their peers rather than for, like, the broad network that they have on Facebook.
So Facebook's changing into sort of a family social media stop. You can even see posts from grandma, as you mentioned.
Yes,
so, but do you expect that youth that are dropping out or choosing not to join it now will then, as family becomes more important in their lives and they develop their own families, that something like Facebook or Facebook, if it survives, which is highly likely, that they'll return to it or sign up?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, and I do think that, you know, as they get out of like the college, high school sort of environments, you know, when they get into the workplace, for example, they're going to be meeting people who are across the age spectrum. And to connect with those people, I think that it's very likely they will turn to platforms like Facebook or, you know, LinkedIn for a more professional option. You know, I think that this isn't necessarily behavior that's going to carry on through their lives. Once they see value in, you know, sharing their photos with their grands, then, of course, Facebook becomes a more attractive platform. Although I think that the caution with sharing that I'm seeing among those students may hold over. So they might be more active on Facebook, but also perhaps less likely to share very personal information or, you know, in poorly thought through communication.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest, we're talking about the youth movement in social media. 11 million since 2011 have left Facebook, for example. About a billion remain, however. So Facebook remains the giant. My guest is Felicity Duncan. She's an assistant professor of digital communication and social media at Cabrini College in Pennsylvania. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Felicity, this is making it harder for parents to follow what their kids are doing online.
Very much so. Funny, some of my colleagues have noticed that their children have sort of left Facebook, you know, partially to avoid the sort of mom stalkers that are out there. Yeah, so it certainly can make parents, I think, feel less connected to their children. Although, of course, I think that young people are very good about using things like text messaging to stay in touch with and connected to family members. But definitely there's less sort of transparency about their lives if they're not posting on platforms like Facebook.
Facebook as an advertising platform earned $18 billion in 2015. What does this exodus of youth mean when it comes to revenue? Is it a concern?
You know, I think it would be. And I think that Facebook has, you know, even explicitly, Mark Zuckerberg has said, you know, we recognize that we need to do more to keep youth active. So essentially how Facebook's advertising platform works is they use the information that people share with them to target ads, both within the platform and sometimes outside of the platform. And it's been very successful. You know, they're bringing in $18 billion, a highly profitable company. If people, especially young people who are the most attractive segment for marketers, if those people are sharing less with Facebook, Facebook's going to be a less effective advertiser to those people. And that could definitely, you know, potentially threaten this very large, successful revenue base that they have.
How does that work, just sharing stuff with friends on Facebook? How does that translate into revenue?
Yeah, so, for example, if you are not a fan, but if you like the page of a company, or even if you like an article about a particular topic. So, you know, if we think about something like pets, right? If you share updates about your pets, if you like, you know, funny videos of cats and things like that, that information can be fed to advertisers who then might target you with advertising for pet-related products, pet food, and things like that. So, you know, the information about things we like, the things we care about, can be translated into products that then get offered to us by advertisers who are, you know, using the Facebook data platform.
And it really has to do with what you share.
Absolutely. What you share and all your activities, you know, Facebook logs, of course, every like that you make. And, you know, when you go on to news portals and things outside of Facebook, there's usually a Facebook button. You know, you can like things outside of the platform. All of that information is retained and mined to give insight into the you know, Facebook users' preferences and interests.
I wanted to go back to the three major reasons that the college students you talked to opted out of using Facebook.
Yes.
What were they? I mean, we're talking about people who opted out of using Facebook, right? Who stopped using it?
Well, these three major reasons, there's not like great research so far. So these are just things that are based on my observation and discussions with students. You know, so
right.
These are sort of, I don't want to create the sense that this is hard and fast fact. But the three kind of main things that I've found that students give as reasons is, first of all, having their family in their networks on Facebook, they don't necessarily want to share. The second is that those things remain forever, so they're concerned about the permanence of the things that they share on Facebook, whereas a platform like Snapchat, those images are deleted after 24 hours or after one viewing. You know, so there's not these permanent images that remain. And then the final one is this growing recognition that what you share on these social media platforms can affect how you're evaluated by, you know, future employers or college admissions departments, or even, you know, things like banks and things like that are starting to use social media data to evaluate people as employees or as credit risks and things like that. And the students are, you know, more and more aware of this and therefore more hesitant.
So what is it? What do you think about the future of Facebook, that they've got a long time to go before that billion people die off? Or how do you see Facebook manifesting a change that would retain these users or attract new ones?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I think that Facebook has become such a utility for us. You know, I mean, over 78% of the people who are online in America have a Facebook account. You know, they're really sort of embedded in our lives, and I don't think that that will go anywhere. But it might become a platform where people use other Facebook services more than they use the central social media part of Facebook. So things like messaging to chat with one-on-one with friends might become a more popular aspect of the Facebook service. And in terms of, you know, how the company will adapt to that, I don't think that we have a very good sense of what they'll do. You know, these are very data-built companies, you know, companies that are really good at mining people's online actions to gain insight. And so it is possible that Facebook would come up with alternative ways of getting at that data, you know, that doesn't rely so much on the like functionality. But I think at this point it's not really clear what they're going to do. They might, you know, they could very well end up with a sort of permanent problem with young people that goes away as people age up into the platform.
And you said that as far as those three major reasons that the college students you talk to opt out of Facebook, you did not say that they opt out of it because they don't want their data mined.
Well, yeah, that's right. I think that, you know, when they come into the class and don't know anything about data mining, that's definitely not something that's on their mind. Although I have been surprised at how much concerns college students express about data mining when they learn about it. You know, I think that I find that interesting. We have this sort of like story about millennials that they don't care about privacy, right? You hear that all the time. But I've found when you discuss it with them and when they get a clear picture of what we mean when we talk about data mining, they actually do express a lot of concern. They do feel uncomfortable about the amount of information that's collected about them. And they, you know, they feel a bit helpless about it, but they definitely do worry about it. Although, you know, many of them are not informed about that when they're making their decisions about social media. Although, you know, once they do learn about it, it certainly could go on to play a more prominent role.
And you're saying, by and large, they do learn about it in a class like yours.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. You know, I mean, I'm teaching digital media, and we spend a lot of time talking about surveillance. And when we do, they've sort of very quickly become very concerned about it. But it's interesting, I think, that education isn't really necessarily happening when they're younger. You know, they make a lot of their decisions and a lot of their behaviors happen when they're younger, and they don't fully yet know how the information they're creating is being used.
So are you an advocate for getting started a little earlier then?
Yeah, you know, I would like to see, you know, if I had kids in the school system, I would certainly want them to learn about this, or I would make an effort to teach my kids about how the data mining works as soon as they start showing an interest in using.
Yeah, but if it's you teaching them, they don't care.
Yeah, you know, that's impressive. Maybe you want like a cool uncle to tell them.
Yeah, right. Well, Felicity Duncan, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Anne.
Felicity Duncan is an assistant professor of digital communication and social media at Cabrini College in Pennsylvania. We'll post a link to her article on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Smart digital assistants such as Siri on Apple iPhones are quickly becoming standard on phones in general, in cars, and any number of appliances, and in our living rooms. Amazon's Echo, it's a wireless speaker and voice command device, has received praise for its frequent updates and increasing functionality. Joining us now to talk about that and other gadget news is contributing editor for AndroidCentral.com, Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So Amazon Echo, what distinguishes Echo from, say, a Siri?
Well, so this is a standalone thing that stays in your house. You know, okay. Google Now is embedded in your phone. Siri is embedded in your phone or your tablet. Microsoft's Cortana is, you know, either on your phone or on your desktop. You know, you're going to have to be near the computer or pick up a computer and interact with it. Whereas the Amazon Echo is designed to just kind of sit somewhere in like a centralized location in your house. And the microphones are good enough that you don't usually even have to be in the same room to interact with it. You can just kind of shout at it from the other room or just speak at a normal volume when you're in the same room.
So what are you going to ask? What are you going to do with it?
Well, see, that's the fascinating thing is that, you know, we've seen these kind of personal assistant apps on our phones for a while, but they get kind of big, you know, batch updates with the system update. You know, Siri gets updated when, iOS gets updated. But the Amazon Echo service, it feels like it gets updated every week now. There's always something new available for this service where you can check on, sports scores, or you can, control connected lights in your home, or just listen to a radio station, you know, and it's all this natural language system where you just kind of call out to the service and give it a regular, spoken language command and it responds. But this week's updates were all over the place. You can order a pizza now from Domino's. You can hail a cab through Uber, and you can control some more connected accessories, from your home through services like If This Then That.
How do you know about that? Do you have to go online somewhere and check out what the updates are?
When you're a registered Amazon user, they give you kind of like a weekly email where they say this is what's new on the Amazon Echo, as a part of the service. And you'll see, there are also updates that'll show up online. Like most recently, kind of before Amazon even got a chance to really announce it, the ability to connect to Spotify and access all of your Spotify playlists was added this week as well.
And so tell me in an ordinary way how you use it.
Mostly it's kind of part of my morning routine now. It sits just outside of my kitchen, so I can wake up and, it reads me the news that was happening in the day. It's close enough to the kitchen where if I can't remember measurement conversions, then I can just ask and it'll add, or if I need to add something to a grocery list, or if I just want to play some music. It's become a part of not just my morning routine, because it's easy for a nerd like me to pick up something and just kind of latch onto it for a while.
Yeah,
but
I know.
It's the first one of those connected home, kind of gadgets that everyone in my house uses. My kids are perfectly comfortable using it. My partner is perfectly comfortable using it, and it's become something that, it's not trained specifically to my voice. It'll work with anyone's voice that comes into the house, so it's something that, feels like an accessory that an entire family can comfortably use, and it works.
So Echo's always there. It's always listening. How does it distinguish between just normal conversation that's not directed at it?
So just like Siri or Google Now, you have to give it a password basically for it to wake up. And for Amazon, you can either say Amazon, you can set it to either Amazon or Alexa. And when you say that, then the blue ring will show up around the top to let you know that it connected and that it's listening to you. And then it'll respond in one way or another once the command has been, issued.
We're talking about Amazon Echo. If you have a question or comment about it, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. How big is it? What does it look like?
It's a black pillar that I guess it's not that much bigger than your average coffee thermos. It's fairly small, but it's kind of dense and heavy. So when you set it down somewhere, you're not, there's not a huge risk of like the cat knocking it over by walking past it or something like that, because it's got a fair bit of weight on the bottom. And the speaker that it comes with is actually pretty capable. It gets nice and loud when you go to play music. It'll fill a room, but there's no way to connect it to any other speaker system in your house, you know, so it's very much a standalone thing right now.
And what's the vision as far as how many things it'll be hooked up to?
I think Amazon is just going to keep going until they've gotten everything. You know, it seems to be, you know, through just weekly contributions, you know, finding new things to connect to it and working with new companies, there seems to be this kind of constant stream of things to add support to. And a lot of them, you know, when I first hear about them or when I first see them, I think that they are, you know, just very silly things to have added. Like this week, they added, you know, if you have a favorite option saved on your account for Domino's.com, then you can just tell your Amazon Echo to order the usual, basically. And in 20 minutes with no other interaction whatsoever, the pizza guy shows up with your order.
And then Echo can ring when somebody hits the doorbell?
You would need a doorbell set up in order for that to happen, you know, like a smart doorbell connection. But yes, that is another function that can be served.
Is this one of those ads I saw during the Super Bowl that has?
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Now it's all coming back to me.
That showed up for the Amazon Echo, you know, for a couple of different things. And that's, you know, really the weird part about explaining this is that, you know, you can be very simple and say that, well, it's a, you know, it's a speaker that's connected to an app on my phone so I can play music. Or you can try and explain that it can be connected to just about everything right now. It's really kind of fascinating to see over the last year how much it's grown.
And all right, so that ad on the Super Bowl, since what is it, 115 million people or something like that watched, someone out there listening probably knows what I'm talking about. So you could answer your doorbell remotely.
If you had, you know, you would need a connected doorbell like the Ring doorbell that you know, functioned with it. But yeah, it's not with, you know, not outside of the realm of possibility. And that's just like the start of this whole, you know, connected home setup that Amazon is a part of now.
Interesting. As far as we know, so the doorbell, if you have the right kind of doorbell, of course, it has to be a compatible. You could have a compatible refrigerator.
I don't know that I've seen any refrigerators announce support for the Amazon Echo setup, but it's you know, certainly within the realm of possibility.
I'm trying to be a visionary here right now, Russell.
Sure.
I'm trying to imagine, you know, could.
I mean, it's absolutely possible. Any connected tech that has access to the internet in one form or another, you know, there are tools out there to work with the Amazon Echo.
At the time of your second review, you said that Echo could not take follow-up commands. Give me an example of what you mean by that. I think I know, and tell us whether that's changed.
Well, so a good example of that is, you know, Siri and Google Now have both gotten really good at taking the context from whatever it is you asked it before and applying it to the next question as a way of, you know, making the conversation feel more natural and more human. So you ask, let's say, you know, what's the weather in San Francisco this week? And you get a response. And instead of saying, what's the weather in San Francisco next week, you would just answer that request with, well, what about next week? And, you know, Siri and Google Now and Cortana will, you know, understand that when you ask that question, you're referring to the previous instruction that you gave, and we'll use that to answer the question. There's not a lot of that kind of natural language set up in Amazon Echo yet. It's still very much a call and response system, but it's also not particularly hard for Amazon to add it, you know, with a system update at some point in the future.
Right. Okay. So interesting. Continue to enjoy it. Keep us posted on Amazon Echo. iPhone has an update that makes some devices unusable, and it sounds like Apple doesn't want to take responsibility for this. Why is the iOS 9 update, causing an error in some phones? What's going on?
So there are a handful of people who discovered that this message that said error 53 showed up on their iPhone when the iOS 9.3 update rolled out, and part of what was going on there, it was determined that a lot of these people had broken their screen at some point and actually gone to someone who wasn't Apple to get their screen replaced. Because there are a lot of, you can walk into a mall now, a lot of malls, and have, you know, someone sitting right there in the mall who will, you know, open up your phone and replace the screen for you. And it's often significantly less expensive than the manufacturer would, you know, charge to fix something like that, especially if you don't have AppleCare insurance.
Mm-hmm.
This third party replacement, it's, you know, not using official Apple parts, you know, to make that change. And Apple now has a way to detect that. And if they detect that your phone is using unofficial parts on the screen, specifically near the fingerprint sensor, then this error 53 will show up, and it can actually, you know, permanently make it so that your phone is not operable.
Well, what right does Apple have to do that?
The right that Apple has is to ensure, you know, that they can't guarantee the safety of the data on the fingerprint sensor in order to, you know, to keep you as a user safe. So that's the decision that they made, was that they could either be all or nothing when it came to offering security. And by having that setup, it definitely seems like a stretch, you know, making it so that you can completely wipe your phone or maybe just disable the fingerprint sensor, you know, or some possible options there. But the concern that Apple has raised is that it's possible for someone to take your phone and try and extract fingerprint information from the sensor, you know, through this kind of manual process. And in doing so, could gain access to your phone and gain access to your personal information. And you know, a lot of the concerns we have around fingerprints and identity theft stem from these very problems. You know, so Apple's solution is to you know, do what they do with a lot of things, really, and just kind of be the sentry at the gate and say, you know, you either play by our rules or you're not allowed in the sandbox.
Yeah. So are they adequately informing people of this?
No. This is not something that anybody knew about until the update rolled out. They were.
Are you there, Russell? Looks like we lost Russell Holley. So let's try to get him back. In the meantime, you know, you can leave me hanging out here in the wind, people, or you can give us a call and tell us what you think about Apple's update on its iOS 9, the iOS 9 update, I should say, causing an error in some phones when you go to have a third party repair done. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're going to find out. Hopefully we'll get Russell back and he'll talk more about this because I'm sort of intrigued by it. But do you have an iPhone? Have you had repairs, third-party repairs done to it? Have you had a problem with this iOS 9 update? Call us, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Hey, Russell, are you there?
I am.
Okay, what happened?
I have no idea.
Ah, the mystery of technology. all right, so now people are starting to discover this, but I read, I think, that it's not just with third-party operators that there's been problems with Apple repairing their own phones.
That one's been a little hard to track down, okay. You know, exactly how authentic that is. You know, so I'm certainly not going to call anyone a liar, but it's not something that Apple has stepped up and been like, you know, yes, this is a thing that happened, and we've, you know, I'm sure that in that situation, you know, because there's documentation and Apple was the one that provided the screen repair, that they would go and make the replacement.
Mm-hmm.
But it kind of puts the people who are offering these third-party repairs in a terrible situation because, you know, not only did the people, you know, making this purchase to get the repair not know, but the you know, people offering the service had no way of knowing that this was going to cause this update to behave this way.
So if you get this error on your phone because you've had a third-party repair done, how do you fix it? What's next?
Well, there are a couple of options available to you. The first is to go to Apple and see if there's a way to clear it. The other option is to not update your phone. But there is an ongoing conversation about, you know, being able to just kind of bypass this without using the fingerprint sensor on your phone, because that's Apple's big argument right now, is that the fingerprint sensor is, you know, a point of vulnerability that could, you know, damage your ability to be safe on the internet. So if that were disabled, you know, in the future, then it would seem likely that wouldn't be as big a problem.
Okay. So, but if it is Will Apple fix this? Will they put it right?
It doesn't seem like it. It seems like in most cases, this is, you know, the problem is that it's a third party, you know, piece that's been offered, and they'll offer to, you know, replace it with an official part, but they're going to charge you for that service.
Okay. Facebook app can be a big drain on battery life. Is this on all smartphones or just some or what?
It seems like, you know, both with the iPhone and Android, that there are a lot of people who have discovered quite recently that if you go and uninstall Facebook from your phone and then continue using your phone as though you normally would, that you know, you get quite a bit in the way of battery life back.
Well, why is this? What's the problem? Is it just Facebook just takes up too much?
Facebook does a lot on your phone. I think a lot of people don't understand just how much Facebook as an app does.
At your expense.
For you as well. You know, yeah. Constant location checks so that you get these pop-ups that say, hey, you know, your friend has checked into this restaurant here a couple of times recently, keeping an eye on your photos and you know, being able to be awake to serve you notifications and things like that. There are a lot of the parts of the Facebook app that are, you know, functional to a lot of people. But, you know, each one of those things as kind of a separate, even if you break them out as separate apps, you know, they consume quite a bit in the way of power. Not to mention, you know, just the time that you would spend browsing on Facebook when you scroll through, you know, just a text wall doesn't consume a whole lot in the way of power. But when you scroll through, you know, a Facebook feed, there are quite frequently videos that auto, you know, start playing as soon as you scroll past them and things like that. And those things consume quite a bit more power as well, because you have to have the resources there to start playing the video automatically.
So it's a bigger drain on like Android phones than it is on iPhones?
It's not as easy to measure how the battery is consumed on an iPhone to make that statement for sure, but it certainly seems like there are upwards of 20% battery return from uninstalling it on an Android phone versus the benefit that you get probably about an hour in either direction from having it on your iPhone.
And what is Facebook doing to fix the problem?
Not at all. They don't see it as a problem.
Why?
Because they're offering all of these, you know, features as a part of their app to offer these services to you. And that's how, as far as they're concerned, it's working as intended.
A Reddit user found that when Facebook and Facebook Messenger apps were uninstalled, the other apps launched 15% faster. Has there been any evidence to support that claim?
It's going to vary from phone to phone, so it's a difficult thing to track down. And that was another one that's easier to track down on an Android phone. But yes, when you consider several of the processes that Facebook have are kind of always running in the background. So when those processes aren't there, then the computer is able to launch things faster because there's less things going on.
Okay. Well, Russell Holley, thank you so much. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
As always, Russell Holley is contributing editor for AndroidCentral.com. Thanks to the Allside staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Shia Lanat, Allside's interns Summer Cartwright, Khalid Moalim, and Sydney Schaefer, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Thanks again for listening. This is Allside with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.